There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
In the market for investment-worthy bags, watches, and fine jewelry, Rebag is the answer. Rebag is a luxury resale platform where each piece is carefully inspected by experts to ensure quality and authenticity. Use Rebag to buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Louis Vuitton, Chanel, and Cartier. Head to Rebag.com and get up to 15% off your first purchase as a member with code REBAGNEW. Shop today at Rebag.com. That's REBAG.com. And use promo code REBAGNEW for up to 15% off your first purchase as a member.
There were three ravens sat on a tree. Down a down, hey, down a down. They were as black as they might be with a down. One of them said to his mate, "Where shall we our breakfast take? With a down, dairy, 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 down, down."
Welcome to Magic and Medicine, a bonus series of the Three Ravens podcast, all about superstitious spells, crazy charms, and some downright revolting remedies. Mm-hmm. In this episode, we'll be finding out about the history of humanity's fascination with crystals, which English king owned a gemstone which he believed made him invincible in battle, which stone is a protection against drunkenness, and whether there's any science behind the use of crystals in healing. I'm Eleanor Conlon, and I'm charging my quartzes by the light of the full moon so they'll be good and ready to heal my co-host, Martin Vaux.
Hello, and welcome back to our first bonus episode of Series 4. We've got lots of exciting things coming up this series, with brand new bestiary dying arts and something wicked episodes coming too, and of course, our brand new local legends releases alongside our main county episodes.
Of course, in addition to all those good things, there are further good things over at our Patreon, including exclusive stories, episodes of the Three Ravens Film Club, Patreon special episodes, and our monthly newsletter. You can find out more and subscribe for just $3 a month or $6 a month at patreon.com/Three Ravens Podcast.
In fact, just today, there's a brand new episode of the Three Ravens Film Club all about the 2022 folk horror movie Men. But for now, Eleanor, you've been burrowing your head into a pile of books to find out all about rocks.
I have. I must say, I've always rather thought that our fascination with crystals, and particularly crystal healing, is a very modern thing.
Yeah.
I associate the use of crystals in magical and healing practices with New Age culture, sort of transcending the boundaries of religious and spiritual beliefs.
Yeah, but when you say that, immediately I start thinking about hoards of gems. That's not the case, is it?
It's not at all. I was so wrong. Humanity's affinity with stones and crystals is absolutely ancient. The earliest reference to crystals being used practically rather than just for decorative purposes comes from the ancient Mesopotamians, who included crystals in magic formulas. We know about this because there are extensive cuneiform records and spell books recovered from the Library of Ashurbanipal in Nineveh, and these date from the first millennium BC.
Goodness me, and that, for the record, is the first kind of record we have of human writing, really. The ancient Mesopotamians, they are where our ability to write things down started.
We're really fortunate to have these records because they tell us how early practitioners of magic would have performed rituals and about the kinds of objects that they believed could be used within or independently of ritual practices. Objects, including crystals, were used in early apotropaic magic in ancient Mesopotamia to avert crises and protect homes.
Okay, this is amazing. I'm so excited. And so scholars have been able to interpret this through translating the cuneiform, is that right?
Yes, that's right. It was an incredibly complex writing system, and by the 3rd millennium BC, it was being used for an amazing variety of documents, including economic, literary, religious, academic, and political, not to mention medicinal and magical. Crystals like lapis lazuli and serpentine were very popular in art and jewellery at the time, as well as in spell work.
Yeah, so I'm a little bit aware of this, but what are the particular properties of those two crystals?
Well, serpentine is used as an aid to meditation and spiritual exploration, and it's also associated with longevity and correcting emotional and mental imbalances. It's said to help you feel more in control of your life.
Mm.
In appearance, it's usually green or red, mottled with brown, black or white. It's also actually natively sourced in the UK, especially in Cornwall, so we should get our hands on some.
Oh, that's really interesting. That sounds useful. Let's take control of our lives with some serpentine. And what about lapis lazuli? I know you've got a lapis bracelet. It's very pretty. It's kind of deep blue colour, flecked with gold, and lapis lazuli was, of course, very important to the ancient Mesopotamian goddess of love.
Yeah, it certainly is pretty, and it has multiple uses and correspondences within crystal work. Although, I must say, I've never been quite aware of that when wearing my bracelet. Variously, lapis lazuli is said to help with deep breath, enlightenment, stress release, blocking psychic attack, harmonising physical, emotional, mental and spiritual levels, revealing inner truth, amplifying the higher faculties of the mind, aiding expression of feelings and emotions, alleviating headaches, the list goes on.
Yeah, so it's a very hard-working stone in that case. I mean, on the one hand, you can see why the ancient Mesopotamians were keen on it, but it also starts to raise a few doubts in my mind about whether these stones really do what people say they do.
Well, the ancient Egyptians also liked it, along with emerald, turquoise, carnelian and quartz. Although ancient Egyptians primarily used crystals in protective magic, particularly in amulets, which I'll talk a bit more about in a bit, but they were also used aesthetically, not only in jewellery, which was often made with specific magical purposes too, but also in cosmetics. Like malachite, for example, could be ground to a very fine powder and used as a bright green eyeshadow. And kohl eye makeup comes from galena.
Yeah, okay. So, I mean, theoretically, Egyptians were applying makeup with magical properties, but also, isn't grinding up malachite a really bad idea?
Yes. I mean, if we follow the theory, then you might well be wearing eyeliner and eyeshadow, which assists you with spiritual balance.
Cool.
But malachite dust is incredibly toxic. So I wouldn't actually recommend using this if you're thinking of having a go at making your own makeup today.
No.
Its bright green colour, though, was considered to be very powerful. And green stones were often used in funeral ceremonies to signify the heart of the deceased.
That's fascinating. Because when we think about green nowadays, we associate it with cash on the one hand. Mm-hmm. And we also think about it as being the colour of jealousy, like the green-eyed monster.
Yeah, but there's a tradition of green stones being lucky across various cultures. I'm thinking in particular of ancient China, where jade was incredibly highly valued.
Of course, yeah.
Precious objects are made from it. One of the first emperors had a set of armour made out of jade, which was an incredibly valuable object. Similarly, it was recognised as a powerful good luck charm in Mexico. And jade also represented the ancestor spirits for the ancient Maoris of New Zealand and was often worn in pendants. So green is sort of funeral, ancestors, and good luck.
Wow, that's fascinating. So I actually keep a malachite palm stone on my desk, so I've been courting good luck without even realising, and potentially corresponding with my ancestors. Ooh. Anyway, it's so interesting to be able to draw a line from the ancient civilizations you've been talking about to this little piece of stone I just hold when I need calming down.
We actually get the word crystal from the ancient Greeks.
Really?
It comes from their word for ice, because they believed that clear quartz crystals were actually water which had frozen so solidly it would never melt.
Makes perfect sense.
They also used crystals and ores in ritual practices associated with the gods, so different crystals for different gods. For example, hematite, which is a type of iron ore.
Yeah.
And its name comes from the Greek word for blood, hema, because it turns red when it oxidizes. And also because soldiers would rub it all over their bodies before battle in the belief it would make them invulnerable, because iron was connected to Ares, the god of war.
Well, that's absolutely fantastic. I'd imagine, though, that's the kind of theory that could be quite quickly tested and proved not entirely correct.
Yes. I mean, I think it's hopeful at best, isn't it? You've rubbed the iron ore all over your body in the hope that Ares will smile upon you.
Yeah.
But the chances are, if he smiles upon you, he may not smile upon 10 of your best friends.
Indeed. And also, you know, I guess if your mate Brian gets shot or something, then you're just like, didn't rub enough ore on himself.
Yeah, not enough hematite on his knees. We know that the ancient Greeks also attributed properties to various stones, some of which have actually given the stones the names we use for them today.
Yeah.
For example, amethyst was often worn in the form of an amulet or other jewellery before a heavy night of drinking.
Really?
Yeah. The word amethyst actually translates as not drunken.
Not drunk?
Because ancient Greek boozers believed that it would prevent excessive drunkenness and also protect them from the hangover the next day.
Oh, we must remember that for the next time we pop the cork on some celebratory champagne. Put the amethyst on first.
Yes.
I do find the use of amulets and talismans truly fascinating. The idea of this portable charm which travels about with you, casting an area effect magic almost. Archaeologists have discovered some incredibly old ones too. I remember reading that an amulet made of Baltic amber, I think, had been found, which dates from 30,000 years ago. And all sorts of things have been found in Paleolithic graves, although we can only really guess at their significance because when we find them, they're out of context.
Yes, we also know that crystals and gemstones have played a part in a variety of religions across history.
Yeah.
In the Christian Bible, we have the fabulously blingy breastplate of Aaron, a sacred piece of clothing worn by the high priest of the Israelites to communicate with God.
Wow, you put your breastplate on and that gives you basically a mobile phone.
Yes, and this breastplate features 12 gemstones. And the exact layout is actually described in loving detail in the book of Exodus.
Oh, do you have
ready?
The description?
Here we go. This is the breastplate. It is to be square, a span long and a span wide, and folded double. Then mount 4 rows of precious stones on it. The first row shall be carnelian, chrysolite, and beryl. The second row shall be turquoise, lapis lazuli, and emerald. The third row shall be jacinth, agate, and amethyst. The fourth row shall be topaz, onyx, and jasper. Mount them in gold filigree settings. There are to be 12 stones, one for each of the names of the sons of Israel, each engraved like a seal with the name of one of the 12 tribes.
Wow, I've been praying all wrong when I've been trying to communicate with deities, haven't I?
Yeah, you should have had your special breastplate.
Special gem armour.
This piece of clothing, garment, was also believed to contain the Urim and Thummim, which we discussed on our episode about scrying in connection to Joseph Smith and the Church of the Latter-day Saints. So they're sacred stones, which Joseph Smith claimed to use to communicate with God.
It's an incredibly intricate sounding garment. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting that it features 12 gemstones. We get a lot of 12 patterns in folklore and the folk tradition, don't we? The sons of Israel, the months of the year, the signs of the zodiac. Actually, is there any connection between the 12 stones of the breastplate of Aaron and the 12 birthstones? Because they're quite a famous thing.
Actually, there is.
Really?
The first century historian Flavius Josephus thought that the stones of the breastplate reference the 12 months of the year, and from that, the modern custom of birthstones has arisen.
Oh, wow. Okay, so for those who aren't familiar, a birthstone is a gemstone which represents a person's period of birth, and they are nearly always worn as jewellery.
Josephus's work was expanded upon by St. Jerome in the 4th century, who agreed that the stones in the breastplate of Aaron would be appropriate for Christians to wear or carry. And by the 8th and 9th centuries, the stones had become associated with particular apostles.
Really?
So devout people might try and own all 12 and wear each in the appropriate month, rather than wearing a single birthstone that was to do with their own birthday.
See, okay.
That custom of wearing your own birthstone is only a few centuries old.
See, whenever I look up birthstones, and we do have several books on this subject, I always find conflicting information about which stone is actually right for which month. Perhaps I should return to the breastplate of Aaron.
Well, a standardised list was created in 1912 by the American National Association of Jewellers, and that's been updated and varied a little throughout the 20th century. But we've broadly ended up with this, of which most agree.
Yeah.
So for January, it's garnet. For February, it's amethyst. For March, it's bloodstone or aquamarine. For April, it's diamond. May is emerald. June is pearl or moonstone. July, ruby or carnelian. August, peridot or sardonyx. September, sapphire. October, opal or tourmaline. November, topaz or citrine. And December, turquoise or tanzanite.
So I need a sapphire then. And you need a ruby?
Sounds excellent. If any jewellers want to send us some, you know where we are. But to return to the breastplate of Aaron, it's interesting that these gemstones were allowed, because protective amulets were actually banned by the Christian church in 355 AD.
Yeah, they're squashing people's fun all the time at that period.
But it seems as though that was one of those extremely loose guidelines, however, as ecclesiastical rings, for example, were often made of sapphire. And in the 11th century, a chap called Marbodus, who was the Bishop of Rennes, claimed that the wearing of agate would make you more agreeable and higher in God's favour.
Yeah, okay, so it sounds like Marbodus hadn't got the memo.
No, he wanted to wear his amulet of agate that would make him higher in God's favour.
And that's the thing about these gems, isn't it? These crystals are beautiful to look at, so naturally human beings gravitate towards them. It's the magical properties aspect that I find so curious.
And there are numerous references within religious texts. For example, carbuncles, yeah, which is an old word for any red stone. They pop up all over the Bible. They symbolise Christ's blood, and they are just any jewel can be described as a carbuncle.
Sure.
We also see references to gemstones across other religions. In Hinduism, you've got the Kalpa tree, which represents an offering to the gods, and it's said to be a tree made entirely of precious stones.
Whoa.
Which is quite an amazing image,
yeah,
isn't it? There's a 7th century Buddhist text which describes a diamond throne near the tree of knowledge where Siddhartha meditated.
Would not be comfortable, I've got to say.
Possibly not, no. Notice it's just near where Siddhartha meditated, yeah, not actually under Siddhartha. And in the Quran, the 4th heaven is composed entirely of garnet.
Now, I'm going to think that's also going to be uncomfortable, like sharp. Right?
Yeah, when
garnet?
In the 4th heaven, they also have some nice cushions. There's also an incredibly interesting 6th century lapidary text called the Ratna Parishka of Buddhabhata.
Bless you.
Which, not a sneeze, Martin.
Okay.
Which lists lots of different gemstones and their properties, and it ranks them in order of importance, with the diamond as the king of gemstones.
Yeah.
Which may be where our modern idea of the value of diamonds originates from, if there's this ancient idea that it's the king of gemstones.
Sure.
I was also reading that in Sanskrit, the word for diamond is Vajra, which is also the word for the sacred thunderbolt of the goddess Indra. Isn't that amazing?
Whoa, that's so interesting. And I guess implies that every time you wear a diamond, you're actually wearing a bit of a sacred thunderbolt.
That's great, isn't
yes,
it?
Yes, marvellous.
The idea of crystals and gemstones imparting their properties to their owners or wearers has definitely persisted throughout history. In 1232, Henry III's justiciar, Hubert de Burgh, was accused of stealing a gem from the king's treasury and giving it to Llywelyn the Great of Wales.
No.
Yes. Well,
scandalous. No, no.
This gem, though, supposedly made the wearer invincible.
Awesome.
So giving it to the king's enemy was very bad news.
Great.
We don't know what happened to it, or if it even existed. But the idea that it might actually work was enough to form part of a case against Hubert de Burgh, who was eventually imprisoned.
Wow, one can only imagine how that kind of court case went.
Yes, for the stealing of one magic gem that may or may not exist and giving it to the king's enemy.
Off with his head!
But right into the Renaissance, the tradition of using stones in healing persisted, with lots of medical treatises extolling their virtues, including those written by Hildegard of Bingen, among others.
Amazing person, Hildegard of Bingen. If you don't know anything about her, you should learn more about her. She's fascinating.
Yes, and she was not alone in her recommendation for the use of crystals within medicine. But as inquiring minds became more interested in actual scientific theory rather than blind faith,
sure, testing
various ideas for how gemstones might aid with healing genuinely were put forward. Mm-hmm. A good one comes from 1609 when the court physician to Rudolf II of Germany, Anselmus de Boot, suggested that the properties of crystals could be attributed to either good or bad angels.
What?
So if good angels were present, they'd give the stone a special grace, whereas bad angels would tempt people into believing in the stone itself rather than God's gifts working through the stone.
Well, yeah, okay. There's an important distinction, I guess, to be drawn there, but we can't call this science,
well,
can we?
Well, no, it's really vague and seems to depend on who's hovering when you're using your crystal.
Mm.
So I think Anselmus de Boot, maybe back to medical college there.
And when we think about science and the scientific method, I mean, the term scientist, as in someone who became a professional scientist, that didn't really crop up until the 19th century. So it's a long time later.
Prior to that, we've got natural philosophy, which works a bit better when you're considering things like magic rocks.
Definitely.
But the use of crystals in medicine fell out of favour during the Enlightenment, as you can probably imagine. Mm-hmm. But there was a bit of a 19th century revival when experiments with crystals were conducted on people who claimed to be clairvoyant, for example. And who said that they could feel physical and emotional changes when touched with various stones.
And then, as previously discussed, we've got the Church of Latter-day Saints emerging and a connection to those sacred stones.
Yes, exactly. Put a stone into a hat and do some scrying. And that was totally credible at the time.
Oh, love it.
And then that leads us right up to the 1970s and 80s and the rise of Western esotericism and the New Age movement. It's difficult to define New Age culture narrowly due to its eclectic nature, but essentially it accepts that there's a divine force in the universe, which also extends to human beings, emphasising the spiritual authority of the self.
Yeah, it kind of grew out of the 60s, didn't it, really, the whole New Age mindset.
And crystal therapy started to re-emerge as a part of this, although it was, and to an extent still is, very much regarded as an alternative medicine or a complementary therapy.
Yeah, it's a very interesting point because, of course, we know that many therapies which seem very beneficial to people who rely on them, I'm thinking of osteopathy, for example, and acupuncture and forms of traditional Chinese medicine, they are still regarded as pseudosciences in many places and not offered in mainstream medicine in lots of places. So I suppose what I'm asking is, you know, osteopathy, for example, we know from studying it that it can have hugely beneficial effects. And there are many reasons why osteopaths are not included on the NHS, for example. If you ever talk to an osteopath, I have a lot to tell you about that
topic. Yes, and for you and I, we've both found osteopathy to be extremely helpful with physical pain.
Definitely.
But it's not offered on the NHS.
No, you have to go to a physiotherapist. So there are things that are included kind of in the canon and then other things which are outside the canon, despite the fact that some things outside of the canon are proven to work. So when it comes to crystal healing, I feel skeptical. I've got to be honest. Is there any scientific basis, in fact, for its efficacy?
I think if there is, it's rather tenuous.
Yeah.
But that is not to say that many, many people haven't found the use of crystals in therapies to be extremely helpful.
Well, I know personally that just holding particular stones can have a cheering effect on me. That might just be psychological, but even the psychological effect can
probably
be measured.
Yeah, and it's fair to state that crystal healing's not very popular with most mainstream medical practitioners and scientists, however, and scientifically speaking, that's scientifically alone, there is no evidence that crystals can, for example, cure diseases.
No, that's not surprising.
That may be because the foundation principle of crystal healing is the flow of energy, positive and healing energy flowing in as negative disease-causing energy flows out. But as no disease has ever been found to have been caused by an energy flow in the human body, it's very difficult to prove.
Yeah, of course it is. And what about the properties of different crystals having different effects? Like, we've already talked about that that's like ancient in terms of people's belief, but is there any factual evidence for that?
Certainly no scientific studies have shown that any differentiation in composition of crystals or colours can treat any particular ailment.
Right.
However, It's been argued that because geological forces occur to form rocks and minerals, those energies are still vibrationally contained within every stone.
Yeah, I guess there must be something in that. But if that's the case, then surely it's possible the natural energy within the crystals might interact with the energy of the human body in particular ways.
It is certainly possible, but researchers at the Anomalistic Psychology Department at the University of London, for example, suggest that any perceived positive effect of crystal healing may be a placebo effect.
Sure. Yeah.
So a person may feel better after a treatment, including crystals, but there's no evidence it has anything to do with the crystals.
Right. And placebo effects are so interesting anyway, because even if there's no active medicinal effects, we might not judge them to be totally worthless if people do actually feel better because of them, which happens quite frequently.
Totally. And you were just saying you feel nice when you hold on to a crystal. You feel positive. You feel like your energy's improved. Even if there's no scientific basis, you still feel better. So it's been successful.
I also think the same can be true of putting on jewellery to go for a special dinner or a night out or to go to a meeting. You might put on a particular ring or a necklace to make yourself feel armoured, even if you're not intending to necessarily speak to a deity through your chest
plate. Totally. And crystal healing practitioners often focus on energy and intention, which is often linked to magical practices. Anyway, and we'll talk more about that, along with how crystals relate to the chakras and the aura, cleansing and charging crystals for magical work, and a few of our favourite stones and their significance, right after this.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
So, Eleanor, we've touched on the idea of crystals being used in healing, but I'm interested in how that might work practically. So how might we get started if we wanted to try a little crystal healing at home?
Well, at its most basic, we could wear certain crystals on our bodies in the form of jewellery.
Yeah.
For example, many people who suffer from arthritis wear copper bracelets. That's not a crystal, but it's an example which is quite common. Certainly when I was young, I saw a lot of older adults wearing copper bracelets.
Sure.
Because copper's supposed to reduce swelling and inflammation. The Egyptians' favourite, malachite, contains a high concentration of copper, hence the green colour.
Yeah.
So that might also help with aches and pains. But essentially, the idea of crystal healing is that it's holistic, which means it works on the physical, emotional, mental and spiritual level of being.
So I do suffer with a chronic pain problem. Could we do something with crystals to help to ease it?
Well, crystals have been connected with particular parts of the body and its organs for thousands of years, so we could certainly try.
All right then, which crystals would be best for it?
Our old friend malachite. And sapphire and lapis lazuli, that workhorse crystal.
Yeah.
Although if you want to break it down into specific things, you might try aquamarine or quartz for the neck, selenite for the shoulders, or garnet and tourmaline for the spine.
I'll be covered in rocks at this rate.
Well, that is exactly what we might do if we wanted to balance your chakras.
Okay, and just in case our listeners are not familiar, could you summarise the chakras?
Yes, of course. They are defined as the 7 main energy points in the body, which run down the spine. So they are the root chakra, which is found at the base of the spine, the sacral chakra, which is near the tailbone, the solar chakra between the navel and the lower part of the chest, the heart chakra in the centre of the chest, the throat chakra in the centre of the neck, the third eye chakra in the centre of the forehead, and the crown chakra at the top of the head.
Yes,
all fairly self-explanatory by the names.
Well, it's just, yeah, you've just got to learn the names and the order that they're going.
Yes, exactly. Chakra means wheel in Sanskrit, and each has a corresponding number, name, colour, health focus, and a specific area of the spine.
And I'm also guessing they have specific crystals that correspond to them.
They absolutely do. Now, I am really no expert on chakras or crystal healing, but my reading suggests that if we were going to try and do some work on your back, we might focus on your solar chakra, as it's said to be the seat of the vitality of the physical body.
Cool.
And thus the source of energy for our well-being.
Yeah.
It's associated with fire. That's its element. So we're going to want to use yellow stones like citrine, tiger's eye, yellow calcite, or yellow jade.
This is so fun. And do the crystals just sit on my chakras?
I think that's the basic principle, yes. Okay. We lie you down and put them on you.
Nice.
And you feel the energy of the crystals in your chakras. We could also work with crystals in non-direct contact with your body to heal your aura.
Now, the idea of an aura is basically a sort of coloured energy around a body, isn't it? Essentially, which can kind of function a bit like a mood ring. So people are sometimes described as having a negative aura, for instance.
Yes, exactly. And holistic medicine practitioners often believe in the existence of something called the biomagnetic sheath.
Sorry. The what?
The biomagnetic sheath.
The biomagnetic sheath.
Yes, it's the idea that all living things are surrounded by energy fields, which connect us to the rest of the world and allow us to exchange energies with other living things and absorb them.
It's just a bad name.
Isn't it great?
Biomagnetic sheath.
So you've probably heard negative people described as energy vampires.
Yeah.
That's quite a popular phrase.
Oh, I've met a few.
It's an idea taken from that. According to this theory, the aura or the sheath is in four layers, which deal with the physical, spiritual, mental and emotional layers.
All right. So far, so good, Eleanor. But what's that got to do with crystal healing?
Well, by wearing or placing crystals around the body in the position which corresponds to the part of the aura or biomagnetic sheath, you can perform various functions. You're still laughing about the biomagnetic sheath, aren't you?
I think I'm going to be for a while. Yep.
But for example, smoky quartz as a crystal is recommended to ground energy and dissolve negative patterns contained in the aura, while fluorite and tourmaline provide a psychic shield.
I mean,
so you want those around that layer of your sheath.
Yeah, I could see how you can invest a lot of time and energy in this. It sounds comforting. It sounds like there must be something in it. But once again, is there any accompanying science whatever?
Well, scientists have repeatedly concluded that the ability to see auras does not exist.
Mm-hmm.
But there is a great deal of reported phenomena. How often do we enter a room and feel a particular energy or a vibe from the people in it?
Oh, yeah, all the time, yeah.
Like, a tangible aura may not be visible, but you're undoubtedly picking up an energy.
I have no doubt that people have energy. I think that's very clear. If you go into an empty room, it feels different to going into a room where there's someone hiding behind the curtains.
Yes.
You can almost always feel it or tell somehow, and there's something kind of intangible there that, you know, it may be just super sensory. It may be sensory on a really basic level, but the idea that your aura is coloured, that feels like a leap too far for me. Do you know what I mean?
Yes, I can totally see that. But then, of course, we've got sort of supernatural and parapsychical phenomena as well, haven't we?
Yeah.
Like, you can enter a room and you think, oh, there's something there. Maybe
sure.
Not someone, but something there.
Yeah.
And actually, quite a lot of supernatural photography sometimes shows up as colours or light flares, and maybe that's a lingering aura.
Sure.
Who knows?
Maybe.
But, I mean, ultimately, many of us get a strong sense of other people's emotions, don't we? Although I'm inclined to think that's largely due to non-verbal cues, eye contact or lack of eye contact, tone of voice, all those things.
Yeah.
But the exchange of energy between living things is, I think, the key to understanding why crystal healing may be effective.
Oh, yeah. No, I think there's certainly something in that idea. I'm sure we've all had the experience of seeing someone we feel has a black cloud over their head, for example. I've just never realised I was picking up on the vibrations of their biomagnetic sheath. And that is not a sentence I ever thought I'd be saying on or off a podcast.
Well, whether you think crystal healing is a pseudoscience or not, crystals do undoubtedly have practical applications in medicine.
Yeah.
For example, quartz, it's a piezoelectric crystal, which means it conducts electricity, and it's actually used in ultrasound transducers.
Whoa, ultrasound transducers?
Yes. So if you've ever had an ultrasound scan of any sort,
yeah,
you've experienced crystals in medicine in action.
Yeah, I love this kind of thing. Because whenever people say things like, oh, it's a load of old rubbish, you're like, it's not a load of old rubbish because, example, used in all these machines.
Yes, yeah. So ultrasound transducers contain piezoelectric crystals, likely quartz, which produce waves when electrical impulses are applied. And the frequencies of those waves are actually determined by the thickness of the crystal layer.
Yeah.
So more crystal means more frequent waves.
Of course.
That allows makes sense. With ultrasound imaging.
And of course, that, you know, quartz batteries in watches, like, they've existed for quite some time now.
Absolutely. And super interesting. I was actually looking up how that works because we've all said, oh, this watch has quartz.
Yes.
But I've never really thought deeply about how that actually functioned.
With you.
So I discovered that they use an electronic oscillator, which is regulated by a crystal.
Yeah.
So it's a little bit technical to explain, but very basically, the frequency of the oscillator depends on the shape and the size and the way the crystal is cut. So an accurately shaped crystal will give the correct frequency for the oscillator to turn and keep time on the clock. And mostly the crystals are cut into the shape of a very small tuning fork.
See, this is absolutely fascinating. And when you link back to that list of birthstones for the months that is associated with this, you know, guild of jewelers, you're like, these guys, if anyone knows, they know.
Maybe there's something in it after all.
Yeah, I mean, they're going to be having these practical applications for all these different stones. I mean, I must say, when we opened this episode, I did not expect crystal science. I like my various pretty bits of rock, and I thought it was going to be much more about charging them by the light of the full moon. In short, a little bit more witchy woo-woo, Eleanor.
Well, let's talk cleansing and charging, because
yes,
that's very interesting too.
It is, yeah.
Crystal aficionados believe that crystals hold on to energy, or emanations,
yes,
or programming, as it's variously referred to. So it's important to cleanse them when you require them, and after wearing or using for healing. You should always cleanse jewellery which comes to you from somebody else, as it can hold on to their vibrations and pass them on to you.
And how do we cleanse crystals, Eleanor? I'm assuming a bit of fairy liquid isn't going to do the trick on a spiritual level.
Well, there are various different methods, depending on the type of crystal. Some crystals are regarded as self-cleaning, so they never need spiritual cleansing.
So a bit like a cat, yeah.
Yep, citrine, kyanite and azurite will self-clean, so okay, they're okay. You can leave them in a bag and they'll be all right. Others can be held under running water or immersed in salt water, although that doesn't work for every type of crystal formation because it can actually break down certain types of rocks, so it's not always appropriate. And as you're doing that washing, you need to hold on to the intention that negativity will be washed away and the crystal re-energized. You can also smudge them with sage or pass them through the light from a candle, again, depending on the makeup of the crystal,
yes,
as it may react to a flame or heat. And as you mentioned, you can place the crystal in the light of the sun or the full moon to recharge its energies.
And likewise, you can do things like create moon water and then
exactly
use that.
Yes.
So you say that crystals should be cleansed after each use. Does that theoretically mean that sonographers should be cleansing their ultrasound probes by the light of the moon every night?
Well, perhaps they should. I mean, it would certainly make the experience of a scan better if the machine was filled with positive energy,
yeah,
wouldn't
true,
it?
True, yep.
There's something in that. If you're a sonographer, take note. But you also mentioned charging crystals.
Yes.
By which it's believed we can increase their power,
mm-hmm,
which is always good. We like to increase power. So to charge a crystal essentially means to enliven it or endow it with specific energetic qualities. So I referred extensively to Uma Silby's book, The Ultimate Guide to Crystals and Stones, when I was putting this episode together.
Yeah, a bit of a Bible, that book.
It is. And in that, she suggests that crystals can be charged with certain types of influences which allow the stored energy to be used later.
Wow.
She calls it programming.
Yeah.
And illustrates it with the example of burying a crystal in the earth for a length of time if you're intending to use it to gain the strength, grounding and nurturing of Earth's energy.
And okay, on one level this makes sense. So using correspondences from the natural world to invoke certain things. We see that kind of thing a lot across esotericism.
Yes.
But also, I think just the process of going through these steps and thinking about what you're doing, building up your intent, there's a meditative quality to that, which is going to be helpful, whether the effect on the crystal is nil, you know?
Absolutely. Mm. And Silby talks extensively about programming stones with particular energetic information, almost like one programs a computer to perform a particular function.
Yeah.
I mean, at its basic, CPU's a stone that thinks.
That's very, very true. Yeah.
When you think of it in those terms, it sort of makes sense. She describes the process as consciously creating a vibration or a set of vibrations in a crystal, which can be stored within it. So when the crystal is used again, the practitioner can tune in to the stored programming, like a save file,
yeah,
and access it to affect the current situation.
So in theory, then, you could maybe program a crystal to relieve stressful situations and then keep it in your pocket in case you encountered a stressful situation and then release the power of that crystal to help you calm down.
I think so, yes.
Wow.
It seems very open and intuitive. Mm. I mean, Silby suggests that crystals can be programmed with thought, intention, emotion, sound, colour, touch, imagery. As long as you consciously project it onto the crystal, you can use anything.
So really, again, it comes down to intention, which is a very witchy woo-woo concept, rather than particular vibrations per se. And I'm also guessing not measurable in any scientific way.
Well, serious crystal practitioners might suggest a link to quantum mechanics.
What?
In that matter only exists as potential.
Oh, I see. Yeah.
So okay, as a function of observation. Mm. So in using stones to visualize a certain result, by noticing, the result becomes real in the physical world. That is a theory.
Might need to go and sit in a dark room and consider that for a few hours, possibly holding lots and lots of crystals, maybe on my chakras.
Well, that's ideal. I thought we could bring things back from the realm of quantum science by talking about some practical ways we might get started with crystal work.
Sure.
So grab your favourite crystal and let's try a simple meditation exercise.
See, I've never had much luck with meditation, so I'm wondering how I'm going to get on.
Well, you might find this a bit easier as you'll have the crystal to focus on than yourself.
Sure.
Or several crystals. Really? If, like some practitioners, you choose to have a crystal day where you tune into each of your crystals in turn.
Oh, lovely.
The Crystal Bible by Judy Hall recommends starting by settling comfortably in a place you won't be disturbed.
All right, I'm doing it.
At first, all you need to do is breathe, letting go of any stress or tension you may be feeling. Look at your crystal with softly focused eyes, noticing its colour and shape.
Okay.
Feel its weight in your hands, then feel its vibrations passing into your hands. Allow yourself to wander within the crystal, exploring its inner planes. Then close your eyes and quietly contemplate the energies of the crystal. Hall recommends grounding or earthing yourself after a crystal meditation, as you might feel a bit floaty and not quite there.
Okay, well, I mean, that was just nice, but I'm going to give it a go. Listeners, though, if you have ever had any experiences with crystal meditation or using crystals in healing, we would absolutely love to hear from you. Do you have any favourites you like to work with? Perhaps you have a special piece of jewellery, or perhaps you think it's all a load of bunkum. Whatever your crystal story is, we'd love to hear it. So send it over to us at threeravenspodcast@gmail.com or share it with us on social media.
Jewelry's an interesting one because, well, I don't think of myself as being particularly knowledgeable or practiced in the art of using crystals. I do certainly have a lot of jewelry set with natural stones. Yeah. But I discovered that wearing certain stones can boost our energy and enhance intuition. Basically, give us a little energetic boost with whatever we're trying to accomplish in any given day.
Well, that makes sense.
I mean, I normally just pick my jewellery to go with my outfit. But I think I'm going to try to be a bit more mindful with it now and see how I get on.
And you do have a few favourites you come back to, don't you? Like, I wonder if there's any significance there for why you feel drawn to particular stones.
I do wonder. Maybe it's the innate energies of the stones that keeps drawing me to them. I would actually say, though, that amber is my favourite.
Right.
But strictly speaking, amber's not a crystal.
No, I suppose not. Yeah.
Because it's actually tree resin, which has solidified and become fossilised. However, it is supposed to stimulate the intellect and promote a positive mental state and creative self-expression. So I think it works for me, yeah, even if it is actually tree sap. How about you? Do you have any favourites?
Well, as a true goth, it wasn't just a phase for me. I would have to say black obsidian. What is that one good for?
Well, obsidian is formed by a very interesting process. It's actually lava, which has cooled so quickly it hasn't had time to crystallise.
Yeah.
We talked about it in a bit of detail on our episode about scrying, as it's often used for scrying mirrors.
It's so cool.
It's a very powerful stone. It's incredibly effective in soaking up negative energies. It's also associated with truth and clarity and bringing to the foreground things that need to be dealt with and dissolving emotional blockages.
Well, it's no wonder I'm drawn to it then. It sounds incredibly useful. I actually keep a little black obsidian wolf on my desk, which Eleanor gave me. He's clearly more of a crystal therapist than I appreciate it.
Yeah, hard-working little wolf. And while we've been recording this, I've been reflecting that while many of us who are interested in magic and esoterica are used to having crystals around, I wonder how much we actually think about them on a day-to-day basis.
Yeah.
I've certainly always used them as beautiful objects in decor or to loosely enhance a spell. But since diving into this research, I've realised how little I know. For instance, I have two rose quartz crystals on my desk. But that's largely because my desk has a pretty pink aesthetic.
Yep.
So it's nice to know that in having them in front of me while I work, I'm generally in the vicinity of unconditional love, infinite peace, and receptiveness to beauty of all kinds.
Which makes sense, because my desk's right next to yours, right?
However, I am wondering if I shouldn't maybe switch them out for some stones which promote productivity during times when I've got multiple deadlines.
Oh, Eleanor, thank you so much for all this. It has been fascinating. There is clearly a lot to say on this particular subject.
There is, so much so that I feel we've really barely scratched the surface.
Of the crystal. Scratch the surface.
Yeah,
of the crystal.
That's actually why this episode is called An Introduction to Crystals rather than simply crystals.
Yeah.
As once I started writing, I realised there were many, many rabbit holes I could have gone burrowing down, and I really should have turned that into a mining metaphor, but it's too late now. But we could certainly return to the topic again and still have plenty to say.
Wow, that's inspired me to be a bit more mindful about my crystals. And maybe I'll try a spot of that there crystal meditation. Why not? What harm could it do?
Well, if you do, do you think you might be able to tune into the energetic vibrations that will tell us what's coming up next on the Three Ravens podcast?
I'll try. The energetic vibrations strongly suggest that we'll be back on Saturday with our very first Local Legends episode, where I'm interviewing Suffolk folklorist and storyteller Kirsty Hartsey Otis. If you listened to Monday's Suffolk episode, you'll have heard a little excerpt of our chat already.
And in addition to this episode's release today, there's also a brand new episode of the Three Ravens Film Club out on our Patreon. We're talking about Alex Garland's 2022 film Men, and if you'd like to have a listen, please consider subscribing for just $3 a month or $6 a month at patreon.com/threeravenspodcast.
You can also join us on social media via facebook.com/threeravenspodcast, Instagram at Three Ravens Podcast, or on X at Three Ravens Pod. And we have a lot of fun on the Three Ravens Podcast group too, where you can post your own weird and wonderful folky goings on and chat to other Three Ravens listeners.
We also have a brand new competition open now.
Mm-hmm.
After we received so many amazing entries for our folky flash fiction contest, our appetites were whetted to read more of your work. So this time, we're inviting you to submit original ghost stories of up to 3,000 words to be included in this year's Haunting Season Spookstravaganza. Email them to us at threeravenspodcast@gmail.com, which is also the place to get in touch with us in general with thoughts, ideas, or just to say hello.
Until next time then, while our crystals have vibrated off that way, we'll go this way.
And remember, don't whistle till you're out of the woods. Thanks and credit go to The Ultimate Guide to Crystals and Stones by Uma Silby and The Crystal Bible by Judy Hall, both of which were invaluable in researching this episode. Our theme song is the traditional folk ballad Three Ravens, performed by Eleanor Conlon and Ben Harbour, and our logo is by Ollie James Dare.
The Three Ravens podcast is a Rust and Stardust production, produced by me, Martin Vaux. Thanks for listening.
God send every day.
Such hounds, such hawks, such leemen, with a down, derry, 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 down, down.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. If you have a lot of mailing to do, stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. Use the stamps.com mobile app to mail everything you need to keep your business running with up to 89% off USPS and UPS. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Use code PROGRAM for a special offer. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.